All right, how many guys, anybody work in politics here? Local politics, national politics, anything like that? But mostly just new media people who are interested in this stuff? All right. If you don't mind, I think we may stay seated. We'll be going back and forth more like a panel. I'm your moderator for the afternoon session. My name is Todd Van Etten. I'm the D.C. office director for a group called CrowdVerb. Can you hear me without the mic? Or I may not use it because I don't like it. D.C. office director for a group called CrowdVerb. We're a social media mobilization firm. What is the crowd doing and what can we get them to do for you? If you'd like to know more, come and talk to me afterward. Before that, for about 6 years, I was the director of new media for the Republican National Committee and had a chance to work with many of the fine people up here on that. This panel does not have a political slant, but it can if you'd like. So today we're talking about secrets, what's going on in the 2012 campaign. I apologize. If you read the blurb for this at the beginning, you're probably looking for the secrets and what is the new tool that you guys, maybe as advertisers or as media disseminators, can use to reach everyone. I think what we're finding now is that it's no longer one big thing which is getting the message out. The one more new tool. It is something intangible, something that's been around for a long time, especially in politics. For the most part, has been used exclusively in the corporate space, but it is now making its way to politics, and that is data. Collecting data about users, targeting people based on habits that you can glean from what they're doing elsewhere online, information they give you, and even information that they, in some cases, may not want you to have, but is incredibly valuable when you are trying to find people in the internet space and deliver a particular message to get them to buy your product or, in our case, vote or become an advocate on your behalf. I'm going to start with this slide. The first time I saw this, I told myself I would use it in just about every chance I could, and I think it is relevant for today. On the left side of your screen is a shot from USA Today 1995. This is back when Yahoo.com used to list every single website that was on the internet, and you could choose a topic, drill down, and see every website which was in politics or sports or whatever it was. You will see the red circles are where Republican National Committee pops up. Most engaging, most highest rated among women, and also sixth best overall. You also see Democrats.org. Again, no political message here. Just the fact that politics has always been kind of at the forefront of web messaging, of seeing this as a tool which is very, very effective at kind of traditional 1.0 communication. Here is a message. Come to it. Ingest it, take it in how you will, and then, you know, take it out and tell your friends and get it out there. And then on the right, of course, is just wonderful. This is GOP.com from 2006. You guys, of course, know how to navigate your hometown. Why wouldn't you just make a website exactly like that? Look like a town, have buildings where you go to do things. I love the idea. So that's in there. So political parties have long been using the web to promote their message. As we just saw, Bush-Cheney 2000, I think this was the biggest kind of 2.0 interaction for the web and for politics on the web. They had basically house parties. You could get on there and say, hey, I'm a supporter of George Bush. I'm going to have a gathering at my house this time. I don't know you, but you live in my neighborhood. You live in my zip code. Please come and we will chat about what we like. Or we'll chat about why we like them and how else we can get the message out. But that was mostly for the faithful. That was mostly for the activists who would probably be coming to victory centers or coming to find your message elsewhere and probably have been doing that for years. And nothing really offensive when it comes to getting out there and finding new people. That, I would say, the award goes to Howard Dean in 2004, truly the first grassroots candidate to use the web to take a set of ideas, put them out there, gain mass, found many people were receptive to those messages, and then basically had other people push it out for them. I think he's very famous for using a tool called Meetup, which I think still exists. I should probably know that. Using a tool called Meetup, where you would say, you know, let's meet here and talk about Ron Paul. Or talk about Howard Dean, I'm sorry. And talk about Howard Dean. Tools like that, I think, which brings the online world, I think in 2004 especially, there was this kind of many things were moving into the online space, and people were ready for, I'm a little skeptical of the online, I don't want to create a profile and give you all my information. People were ready for, again, this is great for meeting, but why don't we get together in the traditional face-to-face that I am comfortable with and get out our message, figure out a good way to find other like-minded supporters, and spread the message of Howard Dean. Then I think we will fast forward 4 years. This is a document which I think is kind of the holy grail for what for documenting what Obama did in 2008. Just about everyone I know who works in this space has read it. Very, very valuable. Just go to Google and type in "learning from Obama." It'll be the first thing that comes up. The document basically goes through. He had inside information. He had access to a lot of high level new media people in the Obama campaign, and he said, "How did you guys do what you did? How are you so effective online?" Obama, a relatively unknown senator, who started off much like Howard Dean, where needed that grassroots support to really gain traction, found that people were receptive to his message, found that people were maybe unhappy with the other candidates in the race, in the primary contest that year, and was able to find people online who would then go out and help him get his message out. The big takeaway, I would say, is right there. In that new media was no longer a department. It was no longer a siloed piece of the communications team, strategy, political, communications, new media, who were just, you know, tech geeks in a closet building websites and doing those kinds of things. But instead, new media was integrated into each part of the campaign. The political group had a new media person. The strategy group had a new media person in there at every table, every decision that was made. How can we integrate a new media component? How can we get this to the grassroots? And give it to people so they can do with it what they will, get it out on their own. They will traditionally be much more effective at convincing friends and people they know of a message than we are going to be as the state Obama, the state Leviathan in the room. So that's I would say data is the biggest thing that you are going to hear resonating amongst the other panelists up here. I'm going to kick it off to Liz Mayer sitting next to me. Liz Mayer is a principal. Thank you. Totally fine. How are you? Welcome. Oh, it's Jose. How are you? Yes. I'm going to kick off to Liz Mayer now. Liz Mayer is a principal at Mayer Strategies based in Washington, D.C. Before that, she was a vice president at Heinz Communications. Most of the new media messages that are being put out by presidential campaigns come from that firm. And her own now, but every time I describe in more detail what she does, I get yelled at for giving away the goat and telling secrets. So I will stop there. She was also the first online communications director for the Republican National Committee in the 2008 campaign cycle. So I think when it comes to inside messaging and things like that, there's no one better to go to. Liz, if you want to start, I know you've got some starts to...
Yeah, absolutely. So what I want to talk about, we're talking about the internet, and obviously no presentation about the internet would be complete without having a cat involved. So I thought that I would make sure that we did that right up front. Also, we have an apple, so that helps too. But what I'm going to talk about is making political communication work in the modern media environment, and opportunities and challenges in particular. What I do, just to kind of put this in context, what I do is a lot of getting candidates' messages, getting candidates themselves out in front of voters, constituents, grassroots, donors, also the mainstream media and other influencers in particular. The other component of what I do is a lot of sort of negative stuff, opposition research work, that kind of thing. And so what that tends to mean is that I have a focus on online media, but it means that I'm also constantly looking at ways of pulling in technologies, tools, and using that to actually propel a message, positive or negative, forward. So that's kind of what I do. And the reason I want to start here is just to sort of frame up what we're actually dealing with in terms of the modern media environment now. Back in the day, we were really looking at TV. We were looking at debates, conventions, newspapers, that sort of thing. Now we're dealing with Twitter. Somebody gets caught doing something stupid at a public event, guess what? It's going to be on Twitter. They're probably going to get busted about it. Their press shop's probably going to have to answer questions about it, et cetera, et cetera. BuzzFeed. How many people in the room are familiar with BuzzFeed? Read it? Look at it? Okay. The rest of you who are not, go do that, because it's very, very influential in this cycle in particular. BuzzFeed is doing things like digging up old video that presidential candidates really would probably prefer. It's not out there. Pictures, like pictures of Newt Gingrich with like little toy dinosaurs. Just random ephemera, stuff that can take a candidate off message really easily or amplify that candidate's message, character, their personal appeal, depending on what you're doing. Anyway, BuzzFeed is very influential, and I think it's worth a look. Red State. Red State is probably the biggest activist conservative blog. It's one that I read every day. What they have to say in the context of the Republican nomination has a great impact also. Facebook, I think anybody who at all pays attention to news involving Sarah Palin is pretty aware of how a particular public figure posting something on Facebook can influence what's out there in the media narrative. Web video, I think that probably speaks for itself. I throw TPM into that little comment there, too, because TPM and Huffington Post, in my opinion, have a tremendous impact on what the mainstream media is covering. And so, really, this is what we are dealing with in terms of what goes on in the media every day on political campaigns. And this is what, when I'm working on one, this is what I contend with. and the cat, too, of course. So in terms of thinking about opportunities and challenges, where I want to start is with a big opportunity. We're going to talk about data a lot during this session. What I do isn't so data-driven, but it is very focused on demographics and getting messages to reach particular people. And what I've got up there are a number of characteristics that can apply to certain voters, certain prospective donors, supporters, activists, what have you. And the point that I want to make here is that any of those characteristics, if you want to reach homeschoolers, if you want to reach Walmart moms, if you want to reach wealthy, college-educated Arab Americans. There is a way of doing that online. Obviously, that is true through particular tools like Twitter and Facebook. It is also true if you're looking at blogs and if you're looking at online media. And to just ram that point home, if we're looking at blogs, this is just a sampling of the different types that exist out there. I'm sure that all of us in this room look at tech blogs with a great deal of frequency. Probably most of you in this room look at political blogs and political online media also. But I think it's worth remembering, particularly as politics moves towards being a little bit more corporate, I think it's important to remember that you have other kinds of blogs out there. You have a lot of mommy blogs that are very influential. Those potentially play a role in a political campaign. And even within the political sphere, you've got a whole sub-universe. So you have your conservatives, you have your liberals, you have your moderates, nonpartisans, libertarians. And the mere fact that you are working with a Republican or a Democrat does not necessarily preclude you from talking to that entire set of blogs, that entire universe. And that's a lot of what I do, frankly, is when I'm working with Republicans, I actually spend a lot of time talking to people on the center-left because of the impact that that has on the media universe as a whole. So those are generally what I consider to be in the opportunities category. Something that can be an opportunity or a challenge, depending on who you're working with and what their assets and liabilities are. I think that the world that we live in now in the modern media environment places a great premium on authenticity. And there are a few people that I think exhibit this in spades. And the first that I'm going to point to is Senator Claire McCaskill. How many people follow her on Twitter? Does anybody follow her on Twitter? Okay, you guys should start following her on Twitter because she doesn't just tweet about politics. If you're interested in stuff that's not political, she's actually great to follow. And I think this is one of the things that makes her a very authentic voice in politics and will enable her Twitter feed. And I think she also has Tumblr, et cetera, et cetera. She has a whole kit, essentially, that I believe will enable her to be in a much better position running in a tough re-election bid this year than a lot of other Democrats who are facing similar challenges. So as you can see, she tweets about sports. Sports is something she tweets about quite a lot, actually. She also was tweeting a while back. She won on a weight loss plan, and she was tweeting a bit about that. I think, about working out, diet, all of those kinds of things. So when you follow Claire McCaskill on Twitter, it's not sort of like, oh, I oversaw this hearing on blah, 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 aren't I wonderful, I'm so excellent. It's actually really getting across who she is as a person in a much more real and authentic way than we typically see in the political realm. And I think that's something that a lot of people find very attractive about her as a political figure and why she's a great voice for the Democratic Party to have out there in many respects. Another example, my former client, Texas Governor Rick Perry. I worked on his presidential run. I know there are some people who are like, what, really? The reason I put this up, for those who don't know, Rick Perry actually does all of his tweeting himself, like Claire McCaskill. Staff don't do it. We had nothing to do with it at all. In fact, I'm sure that there are certain instances where it might have been advantageous if we had. I think he did a little CNN chat earlier, I guess it was on Friday night. I think he pointed out that people are frequently correcting his spelling and pointing out typos and things on Twitter. I suppose that would be avoidable if press staff were doing this, but we did not. He does all of his tweeting himself. And one of the really interesting things that happened with this cycle is the night of the Iowa caucuses, news came out that he was planning on coming back to Austin to sort of reassess the campaign. And the next day, everybody started getting questions about this. Well, is he really going on to South Carolina? Because we saw he tweeted. I'm getting these questions, and I'm like, he tweets himself. If that's what he said, then that's what we're doing. You know, like, I don't have anything to add to that whatsoever. But that is legitimately how he operates this. He does do all of his tweeting himself. Again, like McCaskill, he tweets about a lot of stuff that doesn't have to do with politics, the Texas economy, et cetera, plenty about sports and running. He's obviously a big runner. He's also worth following on Twitter just to get an idea of this. Now, when we're talking about authenticity, somebody that has a bit of a challenge with this, anybody want to take a guess who I'm referring to here? You can speak louder than that. Shout it out. Hey. Yes, Mittens. Yes, Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney has a bit of a problem with authenticity. And I don't want to overly knock the guy, but the fact of the matter is that if you go back and you look at what was being discussed about Mitt Romney on top blogs and online media sources ahead of the 2008 election, it was all of his changes of positions and things that he said that just didn't sound plausible, whether you're talking about his change of position on abortion or you're talking about his change of position on his favorite book. It all stacked up and built a narrative that was really online media driven, that this was an inauthentic guy. He wasn't very real. He sort of did things for political calculation reasons. And anyway, that's a primary example of where authenticity and the premium that is placed on it can be disadvantageous to certain candidates. You have to come prepared for that, and you have to be ready to work with it. It makes it very hard if you are somebody who is inclined to move your position on issues, flip-flop, et cetera, et cetera. The biggest challenge that we all face is that in the modern media environment, I think it is much harder to break through the noise and the clutter. I think we're all aware of that to some degree. But, you know, what that does is it really creates a premium in terms of your communication staff. It really creates a premium on them having a great deal of creativity, being fast on their feet, being proactive, and honestly, being extremely aggressive and relentless. It is rare. This time that I'm talking might actually be the longest today that I've gone without looking at email, Twitter, et cetera, et cetera. I'm on it 24 hours a day, and I'm constantly moving stuff. I'm constantly pushing. And if people aren't doing that in this media environment, they're going to get hammered, and they're going to get killed. There are, however, a couple of tools and tactics that I want to highlight that I think are particularly useful for pervading the media and actually getting a message out there, separate to what may be driven by BuzzFeed dredging up the latest photo of Newt Gingrich playing with toy dinosaurs, or Mitt Romney digging a hole wearing skinny jeans. which, by the way, if you didn't know this, actually, a couple months back, the number four Google search in the country involving Mitt Romney was Mitt Romney in skinny jeans. FYI. In my opinion, web video is probably one of the best tools that we've got out there. This is a shot that I took from a web video that the Huntsman campaign put out, basically ripping Mitt Romney for having the contortion skills of gymnasts, female gymnasts at the Olympics. I think it's a great web video. When Huntsman endorsed Romney, he took it off of his YouTube page, so you will not find it there anymore, but I think Yahoo has it up on their video player, so you can go and search for it there. The other example that I'll point to, I was an advisor to Carly Fiorina when she ran for California Senate. I'm sure everybody is familiar with the demon sheep. The demon sheep, I point out, a lot of people think that was crazy. They think it was totally nuts. But, you know, we actually found, and a lot of other people found this too, that when you went and talked to actual Republican primary voters, the people who vote in every single Republican primary in California, a very high proportion of them had seen this video. And we never put it on TV. Never. We did not buy TV time. In California, that is typically your best voter contact tool by a large margin because the state is just so big that you cannot do retail politics. This, I believe, depending on the estimates that you're working with, I don't actually have the hard numbers in front of me, and the way that YouTube updates, it's a little iffy. This, I believe, within the first 24 hours after it went live, had been seen at least 150,000 times. I think it was actually more than that. And it did have an influence on the race. You know, ultimately, Tom Campbell found himself in a bit of difficulty because he had been tagged for being a fiscal conservative in name only. So it's an effective tool. And then the final thing that I'm going to point out is just to give you an example of somebody being very quick on their feet and using a new media tool to insert a point into the dialogue and underline a narrative that they're pushing and a message they're pushing. This is the hashtag What10KBuys. Are any of you familiar with this? Did anybody see this? Yeah,
hey.
That's right. It's the bet. Yeah, the night of the last Iowa debate, Mitt Romney and Rick Perry got into a bit of a sparring match. Perry made an assertion that Romney claimed was false, and Romney's response was, "Hey, I'll bet you 10K." Blah 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 blah. The DNC picked up on this and created this hashtag. Melanie Roussel, who's their press secretary. The top tweet there is what she originally tweeted out, and then she started retweeting what other people were tweeting about what 10K will get you. And the Romney guy's response to this was kind of to go into the spin room and say, well, yeah, but the fact that he used, like, the number 10,000 is because it was such an outlandish thing, and he was so sure that he was right. And it's like, yeah, but ultimately the DNC got this right. They recognized that people were going to basically look at Mitt Romney and think, oh, yeah, $10,000 is for him like the $2 that I've got sitting in my pocket, you know. And this actually turned into what 10K buys turned into a trending topic worldwide on Twitter that night. So I think it was a very effective example of a press person, a communicator, using a new media tool to disseminate a message that, again, continues to dog Romney in many respects.
That's good. Thank you, Liz. I wonder if I can ask you a question about the authenticity point that you made. I think that that puts a premium. I know when I get, you know, when you get a tweet that says from BO, you know it is from Barack Obama. He actually tweeted that tweet himself. On the authenticity point, though, it seems you do lose the analytics behind the tweet. Obviously, a communications staff knows what they want to push out and can frame things in different ways, in ways that it knows that the, you know, polls are going to like this way of a particular message one way. When you give control over a Twitter feed to someone like Rick Perry, I think you lose that kind of control. How does the communications team feel about giving control over to the candidate themselves?
Well, I think that there are two ways of thinking about this, and it really depends on what candidate you're working with. If you're working with a kind of candidate whose personality and sort of straight talking, for lack of a better term, is seen as an asset, then hand it over and give them as much latitude and as much freedom to express themselves as you possibly can, because probably what people are being attracted to isn't a finely tested and poll-driven message that hits all the right talking points. It's probably the personality in a lot of regards. And I think with Perry, that is probably particularly true. I think if you look at Perry's issue positions, you can find other people who are somewhat similar to them. But I think what a lot of people like about him, a lot of grassroots Republicans like about him, is that he is willing to just straight up call a spade and not put it in, like, sort of delicate focus group language. And so that's one way of thinking about it. And I would say also in 2008, when I was at the Republican National Committee, John McCain is another excellent example of this. I think that historically people were more driven to John McCain, not because of where he stood on policy things like campaign finance reform. I think they were drawn to John McCain because they liked John McCain. I think people have the same tendency with Ron Paul. Yeah, there are people who definitely like Ron Paul because they really want the gold standard, and then there are people who want Ron Paul because Ron Paul gets up in a debate and he doesn't rehash his stump speech. He, like, calls out the Federal Reserve. Yeah. So that's one method of thinking. But then the flip side is that with other candidates who maybe don't have that sort of charismatic appeal or that personal appeal, Yeah, you are going to be more concerned about adhering to your message. Also, if you have people who are, you know, potentially prone to dropping F-bombs or using other language that is not appropriate for political discourse, that's going to be a consideration. And there are candidates like that. There definitely are.
Yeah. Thank you, Liz. I think there are time for questions at the end.
Yeah.
I just have one question.
Sure.
I noticed that, like, Claire McCaskill doesn't follow anyone back.
Right.
I mean, like, it seems like a standard practice. Seems like it's like a pharmaceutical company. What's the strategy behind that?
Well, she's been asked about that publicly on Twitter, and what she says, and personally, I believe her because I am somebody who follows a very small. I don't follow nobody. I follow a very small number of people on Twitter. What she says is that she does read every tweet sent to her, which I believe also because I have tweeted at her and she has responded to me, and it's been about something very specific, like, hey, in that interview, you totally just got your statistic wrong. And she's like, yeah, I kind of flubbed it, whatever. You know, I think it was something like that. Anyway, I think her logic is that she prefers to not have stuff showing up in the stream. She uses it more as a listening tool, so she just is basically looking at Connect. She's looking at what's being tweeted at her, not anything else. Her other rationale is that her preference is to only respond to people who are from Missouri or to predominantly respond to people who are from Missouri. And I guess that could hypothetically be hard if you suddenly start having, you know, CNN this, that, and the other thing that you're following. So that's obviously a personal choice on her part, but try tweeting at her because there's a pretty good chance, I think, that she will respond. Yeah.
I think we're going to move on if that's all right. There will be time.
Yeah, we can do...
Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Hypothetically, I mean, yeah, to some extent that's true. I mean, I guess if you're following 100,000 people and it's like one of them, I mean, that's such a small proportion, right? If you get into a situation where you're favoriting tweets or retweeting that, that could be risky. Yeah, that's a possibility.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's true too. Good point, and good eye as well. That's a good pickup. I think I'm going to introduce our next panelist. Danny Allen also comes from Washington, D.C., where he is a vice president at a firm called Census, which has a lot of brand management for corporations and some political parties as well. What Danny's firm really concentrates on, though, is the Hispanic market. And I think, much like Liz said, something like Demon Sheep wasn't made for a mass audience. It was made for Republican primary voters. It is tremendously hard to find one message which you want to target to one demographic or one group of people. And that is something that Danny and Danny's firm, his partners in the back room as well, back of the room as well. So his business partner. Danny, I think if you want to talk a little bit about the Hispanic market, why they are a particular challenge, whether they need their own group of communication staffers or how that goes.
Sure. So what I was originally going to talk about was what the campaigns are doing that's really interesting to reach out to the Hispanic market at this point. And so far that's been nothing, so I'm going to talk about what I would do if I was trying to reach out to the Hispanic market in this campaign. Just a couple of weeks ago, Time Magazine declared that the Hispanic market or the Latino market is going to decide the 2012 presidential election. In a similar vein, Jeb Bush, you know, did an op-ed in the Washington Post back in January talking about how there are 15 swing states in the upcoming 2012 election, and Hispanics are going to be, you know, they're going to represent the margin of difference in all 15 of those states. Maybe a little strong, but, you know, more or less that's true. You know, if Obama wins a state by 5%, you know, in most states the Hispanic vote is more than 5%, so that's kind of what he meant. So this is a look at what we traditionally think of as the Hispanic market in America. You've got Texas, you've got New Mexico, you've got part of Arizona, you've got California, Miami, and some Puerto Ricans in New York. However, this is kind of a dated image because the fact of the matter is in the last 10 years, there's been a lot of growth in the Hispanic market in the Midwest and the South. In fact, other than people that work at Census, can anyone tell me the state that had the highest percentage increase in their Hispanic population between 2000 and 2010? That's right, South Carolina.
Anyone who guessed Alabama, close second.
Yeah, nice work if you guessed Alabama. So if you look at these two charts, one of them is talking about the states that had the greatest increase in the Hispanic population in the last 10 years, and the other one talks about the states that have the highest proportion of their population it being Hispanic. And between the two, there are seven swing states up there. So the Hispanic, you know, taking away the hype from Time Magazine and whatever agenda Jeb Bush may have, the facts remain that the Hispanic Hispanic market is going to be very important in the 2012 election. So the next question is going to be, how do you reach them? You know, how do you separate yourself from your competition to reach the Hispanic market? And, you know, as you all know, as communicators, one of the things you have to take into account is media consumption habits. And the most sort of important and interesting fact about the Hispanic market lately is that Hispanics significantly over-index in the use of mobile devices, both smartphones and tablets. Hispanics are adopting smartphones and tablets more than the general market, more than the non-Hispanic white market, more than the African-American market, and only slightly less than the Asian-American market. So this is a really significant trend. And for example, big brands are using this to effectively reach Hispanics. In 2011, for the Dallas Super Bowl, not this Super Bowl, but last year, Pepsi created this Familia de Campeones campaign, where they used SMS, QR codes, and mobile camera phones, basically, to drive engagement with the Hispanic market and get people to really engage with around Pepsi and the Super Bowl and their family. And they had 123,000 opt-ins in a eight-week mobile campaign, which is really compelling numbers. You know, if I had to guess, I'm going to say Mitt Romney doesn't have 123,000 Hispanics opted in to reach his, you know, mobile updates. So that, you know, something like that is what, you know, I would do if I was running one of these campaigns. So as sort of a test run, I got on my iPod and I went to the three leading candidates' websites. And we'll go from the good to sort of the bad to the ugly. Obama's campaign has a mobile-optimized website. It's a very good mobile-optimized website. And on the top right corner of that site, you can toggle between Spanish and English. And it is a nice-looking Spanish-language website with content that is different from the English-language website. You know, second place is Romney. His website is mobile-optimized. There is no Spanish-language content. There is no way to toggle to it. I looked on Romney's site on my laptop as well, still couldn't find anything for the Hispanic market. Santorum, not only, you know, unsurprisingly, he doesn't have anything for the Hispanic market, but neither does he have a website that's at all legible on an iPhone. So, you know, as far as, you know, these guys doing what would be most effective using new media to reach the Hispanic market, Obama's slightly ahead, and the other two are way behind.
That's good. Danny, when it comes to targeting messages to these people, is there information collected from what you know about how campaigns operate when someone does, you know, when I sign up for ricksantorum.com, whatever it is, do they ask me if I am a Hispanic or if I speak Spanish and I'd like to receive Hispanic messages? Mm-hmm. Or is there an automated way to do that? With someone like Santorum, there's probably, you may turn off other supporters by asking that question. Which is unfortunate, but...
Right. Well, going back to the toggle switch on the Obama campaign, you know, just asking somebody straight up, do you want to speak Spanish, is, you know, a bit off-putting, and the whole thing about for every click you lose half your audience, so you don't really want to go that direction. You know, chances are what Obama does is if you sign up to receive mobile alerts or email alerts from Obama, you know, the website can tell whether you're on the Spanish language side or the English language side, and they can, you know, tailor both the language and the message to the recipients who came from that part of the website.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's good. I think this slide is a good one for our next panelist. Any questions for Danny? What we will handle at the end, if that's all right. Brian Athey down at the end is the chief creative officer, chief brand manager at BHA Creative in Houston, Texas, actually. Before that, he was the associate new media director at the Republican National Committee, but does a lot of work with brands for campaigns, and is someone who truly understands political branding and kind of the sensitivities that go around with that. There are obviously many, you know, when a campaign manager is the sole guy making a decision about how something looks, he's probably not going to have the kind of eye that a trained graphic designer is going to have and is going to make a whole bunch of decisions which are based on internal politics rather than what looks good and what's going to get the best kind of design. Brian, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the campaigns this year and the emphasis they have put or have neglected on design and consistency.
Absolutely. I can talk about that. There's been a big shift, I guess, between 2008 and 2012. I'm a graphic designer and web developer, and stumbled into politics kind of secondarily when I got the job at the Republican National Committee. The traditional, if you can keep in mind sort of the traditional way that political organizations work, there are, as Todd mentioned, strategy departments that influence the political and messaging or communications departments, influence fundraising, and then of course will influence strategy again. The new media component kind of had to wedge its way in, and this data that everyone's been talking about has sort of been the way that new media operatives kind of prove themselves in the arena. So we have to have, you know, that actionable data, and we have to be able to say that, you know, the things that we're doing are relevant and necessary. But sort of, you know, kind of on the outskirts of that are the creatives that are making it happen, the designers and web developers that are often communicating with someone from a communications department or, you know, someone that is like a consultant that is, contacting them for work. There's a sort of a running joke, especially for local campaigns, that if you're going to launch on Monday, then you better call your, you know, assistant's cousin who builds websites to hurry up and get your blog up so you can put your press releases up. And in the top right corner, you can have a donate button that is never, ever big enough to satisfy a campaign. This all changed in 2008 when Barack Obama decided to run and placed an incredible amount of emphasis on his brand, sought outside consultants to help him establish a mark and a logo that would, as you can see, change the course of kind of how campaigns branded themselves from then on out. Specifically talking about the 2012 election and the candidates that you have running, you can see that Obama has carried on the Rising Sun O. It's been a part of this 2012 campaign. It's been a part of the new Obama and Biden logo, and you can see sort of the other campaigns' takes on the first letter of their name as their logo mark. You can see that imitation is the best form of flattery. I do want to point out for anybody that's on Dribbble, the Ron Paul logo actually was designed on Dribbble, and someone touched base about that to actually use it.
What is Dribbble? Sorry.
Dribbble, if you're not familiar, is sort of an online collective of designers and developers and just creatives that post what they're working on a daily basis and allows them to communicate with each other. But you can kind of see that, there has been, especially this year, a desire for campaigns to establish themselves. I guess if politics is connecting with people, there has to be some type of brand awareness to get in front of people and sort of connect with them initially. There's got to be some kind of, some kind of connection that touches base that is more than just, you know, a policy position. And like Liz said, is sometimes even just a personality or something like that. So a brand is established at the beginning and is going to be carried over, throughout the campaign. But when you bring in people at the beginning, I think that this is the point that I really want to touch on. Whereas, you know, in the past, campaigns have brought in these creators sort of on the outskirts and kind of dealt with them through a series of channels. Now the web developer is actually at the table and, part of the conversation. And when that happens, you can begin to see campaigns roll out their online apparatuses with sort of in the same vein that a product launches. Todd, you want to head to the next one? A big thing this year is iterative sites, and I've got two examples of Santorum and Romney, who are now both in like their third or fourth version of their site, growing from, you know, their traditional sort of splash page that's got just a sign in and give us your name and information, make a donation, to now they're full-fledged websites that have been sort of designed as analytics have been gained and as sort of the message has changed from the initial launch to, you know, just as recently as today. You know, the idea is that the designer and the developer are going to be part of that conversation from the beginning and can get something out there that campaigns can start collecting data on and analytics on from the outset, and then build around, you know, provide the users both with products and graphics and things like that that are you know, garnering favorable analytics, but also to tailor new products to the activities that they're partaking in online, giving them tools that they can use and things like that that are well designed and you know, placed on a page to make them easy to use. A big trend, of course, is the responsive design. You might have noticed on the last couple of slides that Romney's site was still a mobile site. Santorum doesn't have one yet. Everything that Barack Obama is doing is responsive at this point. If you head to his website, you can check it out on an iPad, an iPhone, and then it scales to the full, you know, 27-inch screen or 60-inch screen, whatever you want to open it on. But you know, the same way that you know, that brands have agencies or people on board that can help make these decisions and from the beginning can lay out a style sheet to be responsive. Campaigns are learning that it's not always the creators that are on the outskirts. There is a need, I guess, to have them involved in the full process so that decisions like this can get made. To have an actual team of people instead of you know, the cousin that got called the night before the campaign launch to respond to, you know, the things that Liz is talking about that are happening on a daily basis, and build websites and online experiences that are as accommodating.
That's good.
Brad, I think a consistent design like we see here is all well and good at the presidential level, especially when you've got the resources of candidates like this. But I wonder, I mean, can you talk about working for smaller campaigns where they wouldn't have the money and you know, the phone call from or to the niece's, you know,
a little bit,
and I think the campaign, that's, seems like it's,
yeah, that's
what they have to do.
You know, and that makes up a lot of the business for you know, people that do do online political work. I mean, there are, you know, countless people out there that have a cause or have a campaign or something like that that needs to get online, and it's very often the you know, the quickest, cheapest, and easiest to deal with. If anyone in here is in the field, we're not always the easiest people to communicate with, especially for people that don't necessarily are well versed in what they're talking about. We could say, but to establish some kind of style guide or brand consistency from the beginning helps people, I feel like, play more more offense and to be able to stay on message. I think that there is a tendency for campaigns to try gimmicky things and to appeal sometimes to kind of the lowest common denominator. But when there is when your brand is part of your message, I think that you can appeal to people where they live online. Things that we really ought to touch on are things like what a brand can scale to, from a very small brand or a very small campaign that's local to something big. And again, you know, talking about Barack Obama's campaign, because he's got a standard style guide and because he's got a team in place, he's able to reach the 85% female demographic that's on Pinterest now. If you've checked out his Pinterest account, it's a fantastic tool that is not being utilized by it's not the place that Twitter and Facebook is, because right now campaigns don't necessarily know how to control that message. They don't know how to live in that space. But when you go check out Barack Obama's Pinterest account, you're seeing that he is a family man. You're seeing that he, you know, his wife might post a recipe, or that, you know, he took a picture in college that he's not afraid to put up online. His campaign posters and products, and then, I mean, he even retweets things from, or I'm sorry, reposts things from Ann Romney. I saw today Instagram, where, you know, you can use a brand to and the same filters that they use on their site to connect with all the young people that are using that photo service, not necessarily a place that they can control a message, but a place that they can interact and touch base with people that are, you know, where they're living online. See the same thing with, like, Tumblr, like you were talking about.
I was just going to jump in, if I can, and just say that I think your point about how Obama is using Pinterest is really important, because there is a fear that political campaigns have of engaging in the online space generally, because there's a sense that you can't control it. I think, first of all, you can to some extent based on actual scrutiny of data. But I think your point about Pinterest is very interesting, because by failing to engage there, candidates who actually would have a good message and would connect with people and people would personally like them because they're good family people and nice members of their community, you know, upstanding citizens, that kind of thing, they may be missing out, actually, on getting their brand out there and actually having that favorably received. And I think for Obama, no matter what happens with his approval ratings, I don't think that you're going to find very many people out there that don't say he's a good man, he's a good husband, he's a good father. And so it really reinforces.
It really comes down, you know, it's still a candidate, but it comes down to, on some level, brand awareness, you know, and it comes down to connecting either with a product or with a person in this case. So to you know, make yourself a person, to you know, show people that you're not a press release that gets posted on Facebook, but you're actually interacting with your followers. You're giving them you know, special content. You're giving them a look into yourself. It's really all about just identifying with the person, and that's the whole point of a campaign in general, is to make you connect with the candidate. And there are all these tools out there now, especially online, that you're seeing shift from 2008 to 2012, where the risk, or I guess you could say that the reward, is in a lot of cases now outweighing the risk, and campaigns are more excited about trying things that, you know, 2008 was just absolutely out of bounds.
That's good. Brian, I think design also presents a unique challenge in that other ways in messaging, in data and micro-targeting based on a particular message, what's resonating with people. Design is not, it is harder to get analytics on what is working and what is not.
Right.
And I think, I imagine there are times when you go with a kick-ass design, something that you have done that is kind of best practices for what you know after years of schooling in it, you bring it to a campaign manager and they say, no, make it this color, make the donation button 10 times heavier, bigger, put them all over the place. How do you find yourself pushing back, or are there times when you just say, I'm not going to win this fight?
Are there any developers or designers in here? Does anybody do that? I mean, that's just the standard struggle. You're never gonna be able to satisfy your client, and there is a lot at stake when you are running for an office like the presidency, and you've got needs for messaging, you've got needs to hit fundraising quotas and things like that. There are all kinds of analytics that you can put in front of a client's face and say that, you know, this is how things are done, or this is the experience that I have to you know, warrant the decisions that I've made. But a lot of the times it's a compromise. You have to use that experience, and you have to, I guess I could say this, the online space is a great opportunity to test things. I mean, you can see in iterative launches, and you can see in things that a lot of corporate sites do every day. They launch products, or they launch sites that are maybe a week long experience, or that are targeted to different areas, targeted to different IP addresses, and then, you know, analytics are garnered on what actually works, and then, you know, you can actually show your, you know, it's not just a big red button on a blue background that's going to work every time. There has to be a little bit more behind it, and here's the proof, because I just had this up for a week and it worked better than your idea. That's kind of, I guess I would answer that question that way.
I like that.
We can talk all day long about this kind of stuff, but I do want to give time, if you guys have questions, any other things you'd like clarifications on, something in the front row, yeah.
Obviously, like someone like Obama is going to have a lot of people attracted towards him, but what are you seeing other candidates that are trying to build followings doing to attract people to come join their community, those that, you know, like how are they doing external things, pushing people back to become part of their community? How do they put people in?
Is it in the online space or in the...
Yeah, online space.
Got it.
Well,
I'll give one example, and I guess I'll let other people follow up. There are so any time that you can connect with the person when they're actually there, when they show up to your event, you know, that those are people that are already mobilized, and you want to encourage to continue to be involved. Any campaign that is not taking advantage of, you know, broadcasting some type of SMS application that allows people to, you know, sign up right there on the spot, or give their email address, or just text in their information so they can be, it's that message driven stuff. So any opportunity that you can see examples all around South by Southwest that candidates don't necessarily think of. So that kind of stuff where you're not just, you know, handing out a flyer, but you're actually encouraging people to you know, give you their data or hand over something like that. I mean, that's one way that we're seeing it, I guess.
I'll give you another quick example. For those of you who've been here for 3 days now, if you look around Austin, there's posters for the Truth Campaign all over downtown. And if you look on your iPhone, there's banner ads for the Truth Campaign. And what they're doing is they are supplementing, you know, what they're doing offline with online ads, you know, using the media that their target audience is using, kind of like what I was talking about, because they know all of you guys have iPhones, and, you know, all of us. And so what they're doing is they're creating an integrated kind of holistic message such that your offline and your online world are integrated, and that's how they're going to be, you know, doing it.
For my part, I'll just say the thing that I consider to be tried and tested. Generally, it's easier, rather than trying to get people who are already congregating someplace else to leave that place and come over here to this new place where there's nobody and there's nothing going on. That applies in particular with blogs and online media in my world. And so what I try to do with candidates that I work with is give as much access as is humanly possible. And the threshold on that is going to vary depending on who the candidate is and what their comfort level is. But working with somebody like Carly Fiorina, I would say she's probably one of the ones who has been best on this, would talk to anybody about anything. We put her up at one point for an interview where I think one of the questions she was asked was, if you could do karaoke on any song and kill it, what would it be? Like, that's the kind of stuff that she was getting asked about. And that's my strong preference. At the end of the day, unless you're living in New Hampshire and you're ahead of the New Hampshire primary, realistically, most voters are not going to meet your candidate. They are not going to have that level of personal access. But if you can get them where they are already reading something, they're already doing something, and provide them with the opportunity to get to know that person better, understand them, feel a personal connection to them, that's optimally, I think, what you want. And frankly, from the other side of that, I would say also, that's a lot of why some of the people who are most dedicated to public service get into politics in the first place, because they like people, they want to engage with people, and they want to help them. So it's a very convenient two-way street.
Yes, sir, right there.
So you guys have been talking a lot about the importance of relevance, which I completely buy. That's fairly easy when you've got people coming to a political site.
Yeah.
Because you can customize that experience. That is not possible on something like a Facebook fan page, where it's just a broadcast medium to a million fans. How are the candidates using the fan page mechanics specifically, considering it's not relevant to the niche?
Yeah, you can target people through a Facebook fan page. You can deliver posts just to the state of Iowa and break it down. I don't know if you can go demographically yet. Facebook ads, you certainly can. Sean Thibault in the front row is saying you indeed can. You can post something just to women in Iowa or a certain part of Iowa. So you can deliver targeted messages like that.
But yeah, I was going to say, I don't actually think of Facebook as being more for message dissemination. I think Twitter is more that. Some interesting things that I've seen done on Facebook that are admittedly not particularly current, but just to give you some historical examples, soliciting opinions. I consulted for Tim Pawlenty for a while. As I'm sure Brian is well aware, at one point we had the Vikings facing off against the Saints.
Right.
And Tim Pawlenty wanted to make a little bet with Bobby Jindal over who would win. And he went on and said, you know, I'm thinking of betting him this. What should be the prize? Should it be a bunch of Minnesota microbrews? Should it be Lutefisk? a bunch of other stuff. I think those were two out of the four options. But that was a great way of engaging with people. And that goes back to the authenticity thing, because that's totally the kind of stuff that, like, Tim Pawlenty does all the time. Yeah. So anyway, so him posting that was actually a great way of engaging with people. I think another thing I would point to, just from my own experience as a blogger, and looking at adapting things that work on blogs to actual political campaigns, people love polls. If you can do online polls, people will do that all day long. Like, if you want them to engage, just like, what's your favorite color? What's your favorite animal? Like, people love that shit. They love it. Yeah. So, and you can do that very easily on Facebook, as I understand it.
Right. And you're also building in, I mean, just to touch base again on that big red donate button, I mean, you can build all types of custom applications into Facebook. So when you land on that page, you're going through a lot of the same experiences that the actual site does. So like you said, you can touch base and do particular things on a site, but Facebook allows you to customize all that activity, you know, in that space. That's one of the best parts about Facebook, is that you can get all kinds, you can customize it any way you want, but you can also pull all kinds of data off of it. So
as long as they agree.
As long as they agree.
I saw two more. Let's start right here.
Liz brought up.
He's had his hand up for a while over there, too.
Sorry. Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah.
Just,
oh, thank you.
No, but, I'm
we'll get to both later. Of you. Let's start right here. Sorry, yeah. Go for it.
So Liz brought up online video being a great, or one of the best tools, and you brought it up in kind of the context of viral videos.
Mm-hmm.
Are you all thinking, or using online video, like the, you know, taking a television spot and putting it online? And,
yeah.
And if so, how are you looking at things differently or similarly?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of ripping any and all video that we can pull whenever there's a candidate does an interview, whenever an opponent says something stupid. Like, that's my bread and butter.
Yeah.
Obama goes on TV and says 57 states. I'm like, gimme 200 people. It's in their inbox. I mean, that, yeah, yeah. It's a must.
If you're talking about what is going to go for traditional commercial and what is going to go online, I think what I've seen three or four times this campaign, which is kind of neat, is putting out a web video and saying, help us fund this video to get it online in our target message. So you put something up for, you know, you pay for it, of course, but you put it up for free, you then raise a whole bunch of money about it, and it basically pays for itself. I think we'll see a lot more of that kind of stuff. And that, again, goes back to data. People are people enjoy this message. This is relevant to this particular demographic that we try to reach for them.
And online video is one place that has made an enormous leap since even 08, because I don't remember who the interview was in 08, but it was a political consultant. And he said, yeah, we don't really do online video because it doesn't raise enough money for us to buy TV.
And
you know, the point is to not have to spend the money on TV at all. Do the demon
shape.
The thinking has changed immensely since 08, and it's really progressed.
Yeah. That's good. Yes, sir.
Well, thank you so much. Bill Bresnik, University of Maryland. I do work on automatic analysis of social media, language and social media, and most of this conversation has been about the flow of messaging in one direction.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if say something about how the campaigns, if and how the campaigns are actually monitoring social media in order to see what the effectiveness is of the messages and framing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, golly, yes. I think most campaigns are using tools like Radian6 and other sentiment analysis tools which try to do that. But I think it is we are far off from getting hard, tangible, this is what the public is thinking when it comes from the social media. You can get kind of broad stuff, but things like sarcasm are still really not really touched in those kinds of tools. It would be wonderful if you could take a quick pulse. You know, you can do it with polls, and there are other ways you can do it, which are innovative and really innovative companies are doing that kind of stuff. But I think it is in the next 4 years, I think we are going to find ways where politics are utilizing tools like that, and companies are going to see the need for that and hone the ways of doing it so that we can get actionable data based on what the Twitter sphere is.
Yeah, if your research cracks that nut, please come talk to us.
Yeah, we'd love to hear from
absolutely.
You.
Yes.
Two things I would say on that. First of all, I'm not a huge fan of a lot of the automated stuff because I just don't think that it doesn't replace a person interpreting something to me. It's kind of like you can have an online translation system. It's not as good as having an actual human being who's fluent in two languages. But two things I would say about this. First of all, I am noticing more and more, whether this is for campaign clients or corporate clients, when I'm getting clips, when I'm getting war room alerts, it is no longer just like ABC News wrote this piece. It'll be so-and-so tweeted this. It'll be this is a Facebook post from somebody. And that's been the case, I would say, probably really for about 3 years now, that that's been normal and routine. The other thing that I think I would add on a personal note is that's, I think, a lot of my utility to a campaign is there's a lot of stuff with bloggers and online media that they will not necessarily say publicly. They may not be able to. It might fall into the realm of something that they're, you know, they're worried about legalities. Maybe they're concerned about something that they said previously where it's going to look contradictory. People are human, right? There are all sorts of things that you don't want to say publicly. A lot of my utility is with key opinion leaders like that who will be read and will be read by and will influence mainstream media, or will be read by and influence activists, grassroots, et cetera, et cetera. They come to me and they share opinions with me and they share ideas for things. And that's a very valuable tool. There's a lot of times when I'm able to take ideas that have come to me from a prominent blogger, go to the campaign and say, hey, you know, he doesn't want it out here that he suggested this, but this is his recommendation. I think it's good. Can we do it? And we will do it. And it pays off. So, yeah, I think there is a real two-way street there. It's not just always disseminating. It is a conversation. And for my work, I think that's part of why it's very important for somebody in my role to have somebody who is and has been part of that community is not just a campaign hack. Yeah.
Thank you. Good. I think we are out of time. Thank you all so much for coming, and enjoy Austin.